Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us today.
Today, we're going to be reading Chapter 27 from A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure. And this is when Miguel really starts to get into the more dangerous parts of life with Mariah. And there's actually a little bit too much French in there for me. So Toby's going to read some of that with me today. When I was in high school, I took Spanish. And in junior college, I took German. So never did get into French. So can't help you with that. So I'm going to leave that up to Toby.
Well, I'm just going to translate it into English for you. Do you want me to read it in French?
I thought you were going to do the French.
Oh, I can read it in French. But yeah. All right.
All right. Well, we'll work our way through it. It's in French because the people in New Orleans sometimes speak French or Acadian language, which is based on French. And the name of the chapter is...
Well, we're in Algiers now, yeah. Which is a, I don't know if they call it a suburb, but it's definitely a different section.
Yeah. The name of the chapter is...
L'étrange.
Which means...
The strange.
The strange, which is the name of the place where they end up. And as you may remember last week, Miguel and Mariah visited with the gypsy fortune teller, and she told Miguel's fortune that he would live a life of adventure and that he had a curious mind and a big heart and that he would meet with death seven times before finally succumbing on the eighth time that they met. So it was an eventful meeting with the gypsy, and then the gypsy kissed him, which is where the name of the book comes from, A Gypsy's Kiss.
And all my boats.
And all the boats and the blog and everything that is called A Gypsy's Kiss, that's where it comes from. And then Mariah kissed him, and then they recited a little poetry back and forth. And then
maybe I should have called everything Mariah's Kiss.
Maybe. And then they continued on their way. Here we go. Mariah and I, hand in hand, stroll along the narrow and busy streets in Algiers toward a large, well-lighted, multi-storied building at the end of the block. As we draw closer, I spot a red and yellow flashing neon sign. It reads, L'Étrange. Behind the sign is a wooden clapboard building with two large windows on the bottom level and many smaller windows on the upper levels, some with lights in them, others dark. We walk up four wooden steps onto a porch. There are several old men sitting in rocking chairs on either side of the swinging doors, thick smoke of hand-rolled cigarettes spinning around their heads. Some of them are drinking a clear liquid from small mason jars. I guess it's moonshine, or the Algiers version of it. We push our way through the pair of swinging bar doors and walk into an open, lighted, smoky, noisy barroom full of an amazing variety of men and women. Nearly the entire length of the far side is fronted by a bar. Patrons lean against it. Many of them entertain well-dressed, well-coiffed, very beautiful women. The bartenders, all female, are also very attractive. Mariah lets me stare around the room, giving me a minute to process the sights and sounds of music, laughter, and loud conversations. She says something, but as a result of the noise in the bar, I can't hear it. I lean in closer to her, and she leans into me, repeating into my ear, "You know this place?" I scan her face, not understanding what she means, since she knows this is my first visit to New Orleans. Then we again lean into each other, and she clarifies, "Do you know a place like this one?" It takes me a couple of beats to figure out what she is asking me. Although I have never seen the outside or inside of a place like this, I know what it is. Another glance around the room and the context for all the beautiful women speaking with progressively more inebriated men clicks into place. While we stand there, we watch a pair, a woman and a man, put down their drinks, aim themselves in our direction, move past us and up the flight of stairs to the second floor. They are embracing, looking at each other, smiling and laughing as if they are longtime lovers. For all its intrigue, I feel the hair on the back of my neck stand up. My pulse quickens, and I am flooded with the same nervous anticipation I feel on the grid of a motorcycle race a few seconds before the green start flag is dropped. It changes the dimensions of what I was experiencing just a few moments before. Everything is intensified as my heartbeat quickens. The lights are brighter, the sounds louder, the smells more acute. I can almost taste the smoke, sweat, and cheap perfume in the room. A pall has fallen over the scene. There is danger here. My spine and the skin of my arms and hands buzz with electricity. Before I can say anything, Mariah points her nose up the stairs and pulls me along after her. As our eyes rise above the crowd, I see a tall, dark man at the far end of the bar holding a drink in one hand, a cigarette in the other, staring at us, no emotion in his face. Mariah notices him as well, smiles and waves at him. He does not smile back as he puts down his drink and motions her to us. And motions her, us, to join him where he stands. Mon Dieu, she whispers to no one in front of her. Then she turns to me and says, come, Jean-Luc, it will be good. She smiles when she says it, but it feels more fearful than smile-worthy to me. I use walking back down the stairs as an opportunity to change the expression on my face to something resembling a neutral calm and try to control my breathing. We navigate through the crowd to the back corner where the dark man is standing. As we close the distance, I notice the two men standing behind and to either side of Jean-Luc. They are the size of professional football players, but without that same sense of athleticism. They're big, ugly, and standing perfectly straight with their arms at their sides. Both their heads are shaven smooth, and they are shiny with sweat. The two big guys are staring at us. Jean-Luc is nonchalantly taking the last draw from his cigarette and then stubbing it out into the chrome ashtray on top of the bar. He blows out the last of the smoke as we stop to stand in front of him. In French, he says something that, to me, sounds like a question. Mariah answers with a short, oui, a colloquial pronunciation of the French word oui for yes. The exchange continues for several more sentences until Jean-Luc looks directly at me and asks another question. For the first time in the conversation, Mariah responds, no. He looks me up and down as if he were measuring me for a coffin. In a French accent, he asks, you want to play with the little girl, boy? I get what he means, so I nod once. He chuckles and says something in French to the two offensive linemen behind him. They laugh at whatever joke he is making. I'm trying to remain as calm as I can, but I can feel the beads of sweat tracing the fear down my forehead. You have...
Argent.
You have argent, yes. Not knowing what he is asking, I turn to Mariah, the question inherent in my raised eyebrow. She says, money. Money? The night pivots. I search Mariah's face for answers. I experience a whole new range of emotions in less than a second. Dread claws inside me. Betrayal lights my face afire, and I feel like I've just been dropped into the middle of a seedy murder movie where I'm the next victim. Mariah bites her lower lip to stop it from quivering. Resolute, I turn to Jean-Luc and nod. $20, he says, holding out his hand, rubbing his first two fingers against his thumb in the universal gesture for give me the money. I reach into the pocket of my jeans and take out a wad of bills. Before I can count it out, Jean-Luc snatches the bundle out of my hand and starts his own count. I start to react, and noticing the giant men behind him clench their fists as they watch, quickly think better of it.
These kings, says, this sept, this week, this neuf, then.
So that's...
10, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. So he counted out a 10, a 5, and then 5 ones.
Two $1 bills remain in his left hand. Never taking his eyes off me, he holds them up in front of Mariah's face and says,
Votre pourboire, ma princesse.
For your next drink, my princess.
For your next drink. She takes them from him and looks down at her shoes. Jean-Luc brushes us off with a wave of his hand, turns, leans against the bar, and lifts his drink to his lips. Mariah, giving him a look of disdain, takes my hand and walks us back through the crowded, loud, smoky, smelly room. She leads me up the stairs, turning us to the right at the top. There's a railing on our right, looking down over the bar. I see that Jean-Luc and his henchmen have lost interest in us. We walk past a number of doorways on our left, all the way to the last doorway at the end of the hall. Mariah reaches for the doorknob, and I stop long enough to put my hand on her arm, asking, Is this okay? This is where I stay, she says. She unlocks the door with a skeleton key and opens it to let us into the room. It is a comfortably sized room with a big bed, a bed big enough for two. Tall windows flank the bed, and there is another pair of doors against the far wall, one closed, the second open to a small bathroom. She puts her purse on a table at the far side of the room, turns on a lamp on the table, and then switches on two more lamps on either side of the bed. As she does so, she opens the latch on each of the tall windows on either side of the bed and pushes them out to the night air. I unsling my satchel and toss it on the bed. She stands at the second window, staring silently out into the night, then motions me to join her. I close the space between and come to a stop very close to her. She puts her arm around my neck and turns her head to continue to gaze out the window. I slide my hands around her waist and look out the window with her. About 10 feet below us is a shingled porch providing cover to a boardwalk, and 10 feet below that, the Mississippi River. It is a languid version of itself, not the one I would have imagined with the turbulence I recall from Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Across the river, I can see the bright lights of the city's celebration, turning the clouds in the sky above a warm orange color. I am calmed by all this, the lights, the river, Mariah's arms around my neck, and her warm body pressed against mine. I turn back to face her, and she says, It is beautiful, no? She is talking about the view, but when I answer, it is beautiful, yes, I'm talking about her. We both lean forward, our lips meeting and melting together. The kiss deepens with passion. We slowly part, and Mariah steps away, moving toward the table. She pulls a chair out from under it, slides it across the floor to the bed, and sits, gesturing for me to sit on the bed at her side. The bed is neatly made, but it sags in the middle. Mariah places her hand on my leg and begins her story. Jean-Luc, I work for him. I put my hand around hers as I listen. Okay. My family owes him many debts. They live in the bayou, a place where my people have lived for many generations. I would like to live there with my family, but I must stay here and work for him. My grandfather also lives and works here. You and your grandfather want to leave? We cannot. Our family is trapped, and Jean-Luc holds the key. Forever? She looks at her folded hands in her lap. I hope not. A feeling of indignation and a desire to help Mariah arises in me. I think of several ways I want to offer to assist so she can feel happy and free and live the life and live life the way she chooses instead of being told how and where to live. Before I can say anything, there is a knock at the door.
Dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we're working with different editions. Look at your copyright page.
Okay.
And about, so, no, copyright down lower.
Yeah. Well, this is a first edition. It's a proof.
There's no copyright. Second edition. I'm reading the fourth edition, where we took out some words, changed some words. Mm. In there, you say he put his hand around hers, and here it says on top of hers. Mm. And the reason I knew is because you were turning pages faster than I was. Mm. So I'll make sure that we have the same edition from now on.
All right. Well,
because we had lots of people reading it and sending us suggested edits.
Oh, well, that's true. We did. So some of the themes and emotions that I found that were interesting. Of course, there's exploitation and vulnerability, because we see that Mariah is being exploited. And at some point in there, Miguel feels a little exploited as well. He feels some deception and some betrayal. We named those, in fact, in that chapter, that he felt betrayed, that he was going to be charged to spend time with Mariah. And that was unexpected, and it felt like a betrayal. I've been spending the entire evening with her, and this was like supposed to be, you know, friendship, not some weird, you know, charge for her time thing. So one of the things that, how does that make, you know, I guess let's talk about those exploitation, vulnerability, deception, betrayal, all of that that's going on in the, that's a lot to be happening in this young, brand new kind of a relationship and this young person's life.
So the most obvious effect was the contradiction of the differences between romance and this exploitation that he experienced. He thought he was spending a night with a, you know, young lover, his first serious young love, right? And what he finds is it's not anything like that at all. And what is most interesting to him that night was she didn't give him any hint that's what was about to happen. There was no indication that she was completely different from what she expressed herself to be, or presented herself to be. And so he had to deal with that. Now, the reality is what affected him, or the way he was affected, was mostly the shock of that transition, right? He should have realized it when he walked into the place and she said, "Do you know what this place is?" Mm. It was, you know, it was obvious to him, even his young age, what it was when he looked at it the second time. So he should have expected it. It was, I think, surprising in the sense that he had that reaction as opposed to a sympathetic reaction. Oh, you're in this terrible situation. How do I get you out of this? And it was in Miguel's nature, and still to this day in Miguel's nature, to look at a situation like that, and rather than saying, "Oh, you lied to me, you betrayed me, you made me feel like a sucker," mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That was not his usual stance in matters of surprise. It was like, "What do you mean you don't have any money?" You know, in another situation, "What do you mean you don't have any money? How can I help? Could I lend you $5? That was that Miguel. So it was surprising to see him react with such a negative emotions as opposed to, "Oh, poor little girl. What can I do to help besides give this guy my last $20 or whatever?" Mm-hmm. And I think that I think that was momentary. I think he cared about her enough that it went, that emotion, that sense of I've been betrayed, was momentary. Part of it was elicited by the fear that he was experiencing of Jean-Luc, who's a bad, just looks bad, looks like a bad guy, and his two henchmen, who are even bad guy, even more bad guy looking. But by the time he was at the stairs, I think he had transitioned into, wow, what a tough place to be. I need to know more about this. You know, I think that's when he was open, as opposed to walking up the stairs and starting a fight about what the hell, you know,
yeah.
Why did you betray me? By the time he was up the stairs and experienced another kiss, he was ready to listen and figure out, so what do we do now? You know, he was part of it now. Mm-hmm. And because he had been told that he was going to lead a life of by the gypsy, a life of adventure and romance, and well, this might be the first one of those. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it was momentary. I think it was the stress of the situation, the fact that he really didn't know what he was walking into, and in a way, so it's one thing to know. Not know what you're walking into. It's another thing to not know what you're walking into is a really bad situation.
Yeah.
And that's happened to me more than once.
Yeah. And he continued to move forward with it at every mm-hmm. turn. She asked him, do you know what this place is? Okay. Moving forward. Do you want to go upstairs with me? Moving forward. Okay. Let's go talk to Jean-Luc. Kept moving forward. Do you want to play with the girl? Yes. Do you have money? Here's money. You know, he kept saying yes. At any point, he could have said, no, I'm done here. I'm going to leave. He didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to leave and go find my motorcycle.
Series of choices. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things, of course, is that it gave him the opportunity to build up his confidence in the willingness to see what was next. Mm-hmm. Right. And we do that a lot. I think that's how we build up our emotional acceptance of the potential of adventure, right? The willingness to say, yeah, let me go to the next step. What's this about?
Yeah.
Now, I've never jumped off a cliff on my bike because I get to that point, the edge of the cliff, and I go like, no, this is a really bad idea, you know. But I remember my first jump in jump school, like I was at the door and all I got was a slap on the back of my helmet and I went and it was like, okay, this is going to be fun.
Yeah. But you know, everybody was doing it.
Yeah. Well, that was like, the other thing.
You just didn't know how you were going to land.
Right.
It was a thing.
You had been trained, perfectly trained for 3 weeks and you were about to make your first of three jumps and you were in a line of guys.
Yeah.
And the only thing that you knew is one out of every 1,720 jumps is a bad one. I still remember that number.
So he was nervous, tense, hyper aware of everything going on. And that is something that I don't know if you've always had that, but I know you have ever since I've known you. You've had this ability to. Did you see that? As we're driving along the road and I'm like, no, I'm not even driving, but you know, you see 10 times more things than I do, you know, or, you know, when we're at a place, you know, you notice, you're like, those guys are going to go into that Walmart and steal stuff. And I'm like, what? How do you know that? And they do. And then they're running out again. And you're like, see, I'm like, how do you know these things? So you do have this ability to be hyper aware.
What was that, the Las Cruces?
I don't remember. That might have been. But it's like you take your surroundings, you're already hyper aware of them just as a natural extension of who you are. But then, of course, they gave you all this training mm-hmm. in the military to add on to that. And then through all your work, you know, for the intelligence agencies, you added on to that. So, but here it's a very, very early stages. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that.
So it was, as you mentioned, it was a series of yeses. And at any time, at any one of those yeses, he could have said no. So the curiosity is, what was it about young Miguel, that that caused him to say yes? And the answer is, that's what he's been doing this whole trip. He's never not said yes. He's never said no. You know, he could have brushed himself off at the gas station with the biker club and said, okay, well, let me get out of here. You know, and he said, no, let's, yes, as opposed to no. He said, yes, let me experience this. Same with the police officer. He could have gotten on his bike, outrun that policeman's car, or refused going to what's her name? The
Lizette's
house. So he's been saying yes this whole time. And I think this was just an extension of what he's been doing, because nothing seriously bad, short of the bear chasing him up the tree, nothing seriously bad has occurred. He said yes to the ranger, to, you know, extending his stay there to go help find the Boy Scouts. So I think it's just, I don't get a sense that this is something he's doing unwittingly. He seems to understand what it means in each case to say yes. Now, in our next chapter, if I remember correctly, it's either one of the next two chapters, he says yes to something that goes beyond adventure and puts himself at risk. And that was probably that experience. Fortunately, you know, there's a point where if you keep saying yes enough times, pretty soon you risk something. You risk, you know, your appendages or your life. And that's happened plenty of times with people who do this, you know, for a living. And so I think he was just kind of exploring the potential of saying yes to the opportunity for adventure. And up to now, there hasn't been like a serious sense of, I don't want to go in here. Like you have it like, what are they going to do? The big guys are going to beat me up and throw me out. What's the worst? You know, I've asked you this time, a lot of times, what's the worst that could happen? Mm-hmm. And the worst that could happen is Jean-Luc takes a personal dislike to you, but he's a money man, right? He doesn't care where the money comes from or how it comes, as long as it comes from the money. And $20 back then for what he thought was about to happen was pretty pricey. You know, that was a lot of money. And so I felt, and I always talk about Miguel in the third person. And I think it's mostly because I can't go back exactly, but there is a pattern here. And the pattern is the willingness to accept the opportunity with a yes, right? With the whole, well, what's the worst that could happen? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure even, I don't recall ever thinking that, because everything was moving along at a pace more rapidly. It's, you know, when you're in a new situation, the situation is moving faster than your ability to comprehend the situation. You're kind of moving with it rather than a plan that you had when you stepped through the door or even before that. It was the same with the gypsy. There was no plan. He just went forward with it. And it's the same in Latrage, where he just says, okay. And yes, and yes, and yes. Finds himself upstairs having a serious conversation with this beautiful woman, beautiful young lady.
Mm-hmm. And then he begins to feel empathy and protection. And I thought this was interesting. There's a contrasting environment, the stark contrast between the dark, seedy atmosphere of the house of ill repute, Latrange, and the view of the Mississippi River and the lights of New Orleans symbolizes the dichotomy between despair and hope, highlighting the theme of duality. And it also once again brings that Mississippi River as the crossing of from one to the other, mm-hmm. right? From the fear and the tension of being in the main room to the intimacy of the conversation in this room. And that, you know, that it feels safe, mm-hmm. in this room. It feels hopeful and the youth, the hopefulness of youth and, you know, that protectiveness of I can save you, and I, you know, I can do something to make this better for you, comes back out again because all of the scary stuff is on the other side of the door.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing too about that particular scene is that because of the reflection of the lights in the clouds above and then the clouds reflection onto the river, for as muddy as it is, water reflects no matter how dirty it is. And so there was this painterly scene, you know, you always imagine it would have been one of the French modernists who could have looked at that and started painting the colors of the sky and across the river and then into the river towards direction. And that's what it felt like. It felt like a very painterly scene with the windows open. It would have made a great photograph had I had a camera with me. Yeah, too late to worry about that.
It's also omen-esque, you know, portent future. Also talks about the socioeconomic inequality, Mariah's family's debt, and the subsequent servitude to Jean-Luc, talks about their inequality and then trapped in a cycle of poverty and debt, and Miguel's inability to understand Acadian, a communication barrier, represents that barrier, emphasizes the challenge. And it also adds to that tension of that moment. I don't know what he's saying, and that makes it a little bit scarier. And, you know, is he being menacing, or what is he saying? You know, you don't know. That unknown factor kind of adds to the tension of the moment, I think.
Well, the thing that made it interesting, it reminded me, I was reminded when I was in Spain, because I was in the Catalan, and they were switching between this Catalan dialect and Spanish and English. And they would turn to me and speak to me in English, not allowing me to speak my terrible Spanish, but then they'd turn around to someone else and they'd speak the Catalan. And that's where I'd lose track because A, they spoke very quickly, and B, it's not a pure form of Spanish. It has some, I guess, French influence because we're close to the border. And that's how this situation was. So as he was counting out the money, it was very, very visibly, what's the word that I'm looking for? Accurately French. I understood what he was doing. But then he turned to the guys behind him and he said something and I couldn't understand. There was no way to translate it because it was another dialect that's local Acadian.
Plus humor is, you know, a lot of times doesn't translate
right
from one language to another.
Right. You're right. It doesn't.
So.
So that's what it made it interesting. And she spoke all three as well. She spoke French. She spoke the Cajun. And she spoke English. Her English was, you know, left a little bit to be desired. But she had studied with the Christian Brothers. And so it was interesting to see that although she came from the country, she was a country girl, right? A bayou girl. She studied with the Christian Brothers. And that's not free. You pay for that education. So whether her parents paid for it, I can't imagine that. You got the sense that Jean-Luc was like stole her away from the Christian Brothers to pay the debt that her parents owed. And of course, I find out later it's not really a debt. You know, it's a way to pressure them. So.
So do you see any correlation between this story and things that have happened in your life since this time?
So the things that have happened in my life that are memorable in that very similar way always involved, I don't want to say it always involved a woman. That makes it sound like I'm just, you know, a horn dog. I'm not. For lack of a better way to describe it. But there were always places from Reykjavik to Moscow, from Moscow to Baghdad, from Baghdad to Mosul, you know. There were always places with things happening that were outside your normal life experiences of raising a family and an 8-to-5. Like there was this dichotomy of the one side of me living in Chantilly, Virginia, in a nice house on Granite Rock, and my kids going to Chantilly schools and making college plans and soccer on weekends and soccer coaching in spring and fall, you know, and then Thursday nights at the at Chantilly High School for field hockey, etc. That And, you know, being in Baghdad and staying in the green zone, because if you left the green zone, there was a very good chance you were going to get shot at, if not blown up. And it's this contrast, this life contrast. And so your senses are on kind of on edge. They're much more acute. You know, you're always telling me that I notice things. Well, in some cases, if you didn't notice those things, it could cost you your life at one end and body parts on the other, you know. So that was very different from the life in Chantilly, Virginia, that was, I got to get downtown by 9. And downtown, I knew, was 2 hours away, you know, because I had to drive in at rush hour in 66. So it was the dichotomy of the two different lives. And I didn't talk much about, you know, everybody that was on the contract side. You didn't spend a lot of time talking about your normal life, you know, back in the world. And the first time I heard that was when I was in Vietnam. When are you going back to the world? Meaning you weren't in the world. You were in this bubble of in this case, the Vietnam War. You were in the bubble of what was happening in Iraq or Afghanistan or Serbo-Croatia. Now, not all of them. I was not always in war zones. I spent a lot of time in big European and, you know, Eastern European cities. But it's always back in the world. What's going on back in the world? And my world was the life that I led with a beautiful family in Chantilly, Virginia. There was a contrast. I didn't necessarily like going away from it. You know, it always took me 3 days to get over, like, ugh, why did I take this contract kind of thing. And then what struck me was reading the contract and remembering how much I'm getting paid for this contract that allows them to get the things that they, you know, mm-hmm. I need a new van. Okay, get a new van. You know. So
you like the travel.
I did. I don't, there is no denying I love the travel. I really did love the travel and the experiences associated with it. And I was very fortunate to have made a credible, you know, a career out of it that enabled me to provide for my family in a very good way.
Yeah.
So no complaints.
But I can see that this journey was maybe your first one of those.
It was a very, like, I hadn't had anything that neared that experience. The closest I could say was it's like Fiesta, you know, the Santa Fe Fiesta, but that's your girlfriend and you going to Sosobra and then walking downtown and walking around the plaza and seeing all the vendors.
And that's one evening, not a whole.
Well, no, back then it was, yeah, it's one evening as opposed to 3 or 4 days of Fiesta.
Yeah.
And, you know. And having
because you're home every evening,
right? You're home every evening, and you're with friends and family. You know, as my parents got older, they didn't necessarily want to go to Fiesta. They would rather have a party. You know, they called it a Fiesta party, and the Fiesta party was, we're not going downtown. We're having family and friends over, or yeah. We're going to family and friends. Yeah. So, but it was. You know, it was the last big thing before the beginning of the school year. We didn't start school until after Labor Day, mm-hmm. back in the olden days. Mm-hmm. But it was always the Fiesta weekend was a Labor Day weekend, and it was preparation for the rest of the year where, you know, things would get back to schedules of buses and, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the closest that I could come to the experience at Mardi Gras. And I felt the other thing too, the objective was to experience Mardi Gras. And I felt like, well, this goes way beyond what I expected in terms of the experience. And it was hard for me to tell that part of the story late as I returned. When I returned to St. Mike's, and I had to tell the story of my experience at Mardi Gras, there was a lot of the story that was just the motorcycle travel and some of the sub-stories that went along with that. And then the story of Mardi Gras was, oh, the lights and the people, and you can generalize, right? The lights and the people and everybody's drunk and there's more lights and more people, you know.
Beads.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of the damn beads. That's
food. And
so it was, I think I had a good story. I don't ever recall until, you know, as I got older and I started mentioning the story to people, why did you call your body? I remember, you know, having the sign made for A Gypsy's Kiss and for my first boat. And the way that you do that is you go to, you know, West Marine, and they have a guy who takes your order, and it comes in vinyl. It comes in this vinyl that sticks to the boat. And he's writing down all the information. I said, well, what do you want? I said, I want A Gypsy's Kiss, and make sure you put an apostrophe in the S. And he goes and writes it down. He says, that's an interesting name. Where did that come from? And I always precede telling the story by saying, this could get long, you know? And I warned him, this could be a long story. You sure you want to hear it? He says, yeah, now I have to, you know? So then I realized that there was a story in and of itself. It didn't start with bicycle rides. It was just, it starts with the visit to the Gypsy. You know, I met a young woman in New Orleans, and but you know how it goes, because you've heard me tell the story enough times that I've got it kind of compressed down to something less than the book. So,
just the chapter.
Yeah. And we had, I remember being in different marinas as we traveled around the Chesapeake. We'd overnight in various marinas on the Chesapeake, and invariably somebody would come up and say, oh, interesting name. Where's that? And boats are fun. People name their boats fun things, you know. But if you see one that you haven't seen before, and it's like, oh, what's that about? You got to find that one out. So I got to tell the story pretty often, mm-hmm. pretty often. Get a cocktail out of it usually. Why don't you come over and tell us where your boat name comes from? So we'd sit in somebody else's boat, usually bigger than mine, and they'd hear me tell the story again. So,
yeah. Well, so how do you feel about saying yes nowadays? Like, yes, let's go on an adventure. Yes, and let's go for that. And
I would say it's mixed. I don't think so. I avoid becoming a YouTube fail video. Like, I don't want to find myself in one of the situations where I'm the guy in the video falling off the diving board, you know, and splashing into the, making a belly flop into the water. So I've gotten better at not being foolish about what I'm doing at my age. That's it. So, you know, I'm much more thoughtful about what I'm willing to risk in order to have some fun, right? So now a good time for me is dinner at a nice restaurant with my friends. Like, that's a bunch of yeses right there. Let's go to El Moro and take pictures. That's a yes. Let's go cliff diving in Cozumel. That's a no, you know? So I think what's changed is the level that you feel like both an age and capability of how much you want to put your body at risk. And I always do it in the context. As a matter of fact, I remember when we were at Toby's wedding, and Roberta was, first of all, just coaxing everybody into the pool and all their clothes. And then after a while, she was getting people out of their chairs and dragging them to the pool. And I don't know whether I told you, but a couple of the guys came to me and they started walking towards me. And all I did was like, no, that's not going to happen. I didn't even say anything. And they went, oh, okay. Because to me, that was I am not going in, jump into the pool in one of my favorite, I wasn't wearing a suit. I was wearing a very European double-breasted sports jacket and, you know, matching gray pants. And I just gave them that look. And the look was, no, that's YouTube material right there. Dressed guy gets thrown in the pool. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So what I did is I just held onto my camera and took videos of everybody.
Kind of glad I wasn't there, so I didn't have to make that choice.
Yeah, yeah. They were. I mean, it was the younger people for the most part. Yeah. Roberta, of course, she's an instigator. She's just that kind of, you know, she can talk people into anything. What was really funny to me was Francis's sister, who every time I've met her, she's just like pleasant and happy and watching her baby. She has a beautiful baby boy, and I had never seen her. She had a couple of drinks there, and there was cigarette smoking on the edge of the pool and jumping in. And, you know, she had it like there was one of those, okay, I'm having a good time kind of thing. But I managed to keep my double-breasted jacket closed and my tie on the whole day. I didn't get out of my clothes until I got back to my hotel. So I was very proud of myself. And nobody, there was no one that I didn't get any pushback like, oh, Dad, you missed such a good time. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, if they had said anything, it would be, oh, Dad, you are such a stick in the mud. But it was never that.
No.
And it comes
besides, you know, I mean, it's your dress clothes, yeah, and you would have to, what would you do with them? They'd be wet and ruined and
wet, ruined, leather shoes.
And then you couldn't wear them to the baptism the next day.
Well, so. I actually had another one, but that was a different,
they didn't know.
They didn't. No, they didn't. But it was, I think that's it. I think the
you can
yes,
always pull the old, I'm an old man card anyway.
Yeah.
I'm an old man.
The yes has, I think that's the thing. The yes to adventure is
within reason.
Within reason for us almost 75-year-old man,
yeah,
right, who doesn't want to be in a YouTube video.
Yeah,
you know, a fail.
I've had my adventure.
Fail I'm army. Good. Yeah, well, that's the other thing too. Is what could I do at this age that would top anything that I've done? Not that the best years of my life aren't ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I believe that the best years of my life are ahead of me. But what could I do today that would exceed the level of adventure of all the things that I've done in the past?
Yeah. I think just selling the house and moving to South Carolina is about as adventurous as we're going to get.
That's pretty adventurous. So, and I'm good with that.
Yeah.
I'm good with that.
I'm excited about it.
So.
Cool. All right. Well, next week we're going to get even more dangerous. So join us for that. We're looking forward to that.
I think the next chapter is probably the most fun of them all.
Yeah. Well, the next two chapters. I mean, the next one is we know who's at the door.
Right.
So join us next week to find out who's at the door. And, we look forward to sharing that with you. If you have any stories you'd like to share with us, make sure you write to us and
let us know. Yeah. We're always interested in hearing stories. Yeah. Say your bye-byes.
That's all we got for today.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story because your story matters.